Morning, counsel.
Morning. May it please the court, your honors. These two appeals involve not only a question of statutory interpretation, but also a fundamental question of administrative law, and we think the government's entitled to prevail whichever route this court chooses to follow. The government has prevailed. This issue has been decided by four appellate courts thus far, as you can see from all the briefs and the 28J letters. Mm-hmm. Government's prevailed on the statute in the Seventh Circuit in Beard, on the regulations in the Federal Circuit in Grapevine. The taxpayer
lost in the Fourth Circuit and
the Fifth. Rehearing petitions, rehearing en banc petitions have been filed by the government in both the Fourth
rehearing
and the Fifth.
Rehearing en banc petitions get filed all the time, counsel.
Well, we know that.
They have no legal status.
But I wanted at least the court to understand that.
You wouldn't believe some of the en banc petitions.
Well, actually, I do. I kind of see them in my own practice. In the Seventh Circuit case as well, there was a rehearing en banc petition filed, and the time has not expired in the Federal Circuit case yet.
Yeah, do you have a case pending also in the Second?
We have cases pending in the Second Circuit that's been briefed or undergoing briefing. Right. Ninth Circuit is currently being briefed, and it's fully briefed and argued in the Tenth. So including this court, the case is before eight circuits. This is, needless to say, a contentious issue.
We noticed.
And as I mentioned, we think the government's entitled to prevail under either the statutory analysis or the regulatory analysis, and I'd like to address each of those briefly in turn. Now, going to the statutory analysis, and again, this is where the Beard holding is essentially a statutory analysis. We do not believe the 1958 decision of Colony controls this case. And we don't believe it controls because that dealt with the 1939 code, which was not the same as the current code and the 54 code. And it's not the same because Congress added two very significant provisions in 1954. That's 4 years before Colony came down. So when you're analyzing what did Congress have in mind in 1954, it did not have the benefit of the Supreme Court's analysis 4 years later.
It's been reenacted since then.
It's been reenacted. Well, the internal oven code gets reenacted a lot.
The fact of it being before Colony really doesn't have a lot of force since it's been reenacted twice since then.
Well, the reason I point that out is that sometimes when you make changes in the code, if it follows the Supreme Court decision, Congress certainly at least has that in mind when it makes the change.
Yeah, but if they reenact, then at least, perhaps with muted force, but at least the same logic applies, albeit with perhaps muted force where they reenact.
Well, the argument that any time a judicial opinion comes down, then it's up to Congress to kind of look at it and change that provision of the
code. Or look at it and not change.
Or look at it and not change. The point is,
I don't think a Congress that reenacts can be presumed to be any more ignorant of the judicial opinions than those that modify.
Agreed, unless
right.
Congress specifically says.
There's a problem here. The problem is that during the period, number one, when the 54 code was enacted, the circuits were split. So if you take this doctrine that the Congress is presumed to know the state of the law, you get nothing. You get a split in the circuits. And also, when Congress reenacted this statute or this language, there was a split in the circuits again. And not only a split in the circuits, with district courts going off in various different directions. So I don't think you get – I think that doctrine goes out the window, even if it had any force at all.
Well, this is precisely the perfect storm for why this is where you want administrative regulations, because the courts were in disarray in 1954. They were in disarray after 1958. They're still in disarray. Right. And that was one of the reasons why the Department of Treasury made this a regulations project. Now, as we indicate in our briefs, we think in terms of who has the better argument just under the statute, the 54 code? We think we have the better argument. That's not to say there's not force to the other side. There clearly is force to the other side. We have, at bottom, a statute that is ambiguous on the narrow point before the court. do basis overstatements count?
Yeah, that assumes an answer. Is it ambiguous or not? If it's omitted is construed as the Supreme Court in Colony construed the word omit, then it's not ambiguous, is it?
Well, I think the key is the entire
phrase. I understand why you want it to be ambiguous.
Well, no, I think
the ordinary usage of omit does not include understated.
Well, there are five words. Omits from gross income and amount. Maybe that's six words. Mm-hmm. Okay? If we want to give credence to every word, yes, we do have the word omits. We also have the words gross income, and we also have the word amount. The key consideration under the tax law is when you're considering the sale of property, gross income itself is made up of two other numbers. It's made up of the amount you receive and your cost or basis. And
the form doesn't, I mean, the words gross income don't apply to the sale of property at all, so far as I can tell. It's gain.
Gain.
It doesn't, for property, that phrase, those two words, gross income, don't apply.
Right. Maybe I wasn't articulated properly. Among the items that constitute gross income under Section 61 is gain from sales of property. Gain, as you properly correct me, is made up of those two numbers.
Exactly.
So the number you put on your, in terms of what is gross income on your tax return is not just the amount you receive for property. It's the amount you receive for property less basis. That's gross income. If you leave out, when you use the words of the colony, leave out or omit one of those numbers, then you have left something out. I think you can interpret that word, omits, as leaving out one of the numbers that enter into that calculation.
You're doing a very clever job of construing omits to mean misstates. And it does not immediately seem accurate to me. You're proving so much when you change omits to misstates that you're bringing in an awful lot more than simply misvalues basis. Why wouldn't your argument apply with equal force to any time that the number in the return is less than the number that should be there?
Because the words of the statute only refer to some item of gross income. A normal deduction is not an item in gross income.
No, any item in gross income.
Right. And
so
those are only,
whether it's done because of a misstatement of basis or for any other reason, you would say the six-year statute applies if there is an understatement of a number in gross income.
If it is in gross income, right.
Yeah, not like depreciation. If you deal with property, it would be cost of improvements or depreciation or the cost basis. All of those, under your theory, would be would trigger if it's 25%.
If when you sell the property, that enters into basis. But what I'm not saying is that if you overstate a deduction on your tax return, that's not within this statute.
Right.
No, not an overdeduction on the return, okay, but essentially a deductible item in the computation, a depreciation or some other item that affected the gross income.
Well, we think it, again, just directing to the statutory analysis, we think, you know, the Beard Court had it right when it kind of described this statute under the 54 code as kind of a gestalt. You look at everything, and we think you can interpret those words, omission from gross income and amount, as holding for the government. We also recognize, however, that courts have not nearly been unanimous in that view, and so Treasury realized it had a problem. And it said, this is the perfect opportunity for when you want a clarifying regulation, because the courts are all over the place. So Treasury promulgated a regulation in temporary form in September of 2009, finalized in December of 2010, and it said, okay, this is what we think the words in this statute represent, taking into account both the special trade or business exception and the adequate disclosure. And it said, we think basis overstatements constitute an omission from gross income of an amount. Now, since the Supreme Court in Colony itself said those phrases, those six words, are ambiguous, we think that under current Supreme Court jurisprudence, that
Colony in one place said it's not unambiguous. In another place, they said to comply with the unambiguous language of the statute. Am I not correct in that?
The court used both phraseologies, but when it referred to it referred to our conclusion is in harmony with the unambiguous language
of the statute.
But the unambiguous language.
The critical part here, the language of the statute is the same. That
No, Your Honor, it's not.
The court was referring to the newly added language.
Yes, right? The newly added language. Right. And Colony today would be decided exactly the way it was in 1958.
I don't know that Brand X has anything whatever to do with this case. I know that there's been great argument on both sides, but the fact of the matter is that the thing that moved Justice Harlan rightly or wrongly was so-called legislative history, a chat between two congressmen about the 1939 Act. And there's no evidence that any such chat occurred with respect to the 54 Act. And so, and as you point out, the statute is different. And so I don't think we have a Brand X issue here. And besides that, your burden is only to show that there's ambiguity in the statute. That's your only burden because of the regulation, assuming the regulation is properly applied. Correct?
That is absolutely correct. And we think the existing split in the circuits is the ambiguity. And then I can sit down and say, I think we win. That's basically it.
Unless my colleagues have questions, maybe.
Why don't you sit down?
Maybe you have any more questions? I'm done. I'll save the rest for rebuttal.
Okay. We'll hear from one of the appellees, I guess.
May it please the court, Brian Hipsch on behalf of Appellee Intermountain Insurance.
Thank you.
The disposition in this case starts and ends, we believe, with the 50-year-old Supreme Court precedent in Colony. And I'd like to start out and address Judge Randolph's questions and comments to Mr. Rothenberg about what I would term the legislative reenactment part of this case. One of the things that I think is very important in this, and this goes back to Judge Weary's original decision on our motion for summary judgment, is that he recognizes that this case is not about 6501. This is a question under Section 6229, and I'd refer the court, it's page 64 of the appendix, and it's footnote 3. So what we're dealing with is 6229, which on its face, with the exception of replacing 5 years with 6 years and percentum with percent, is identical to the statute in the 39 code.
What about subparagraphs 1 and 2?
Does not exist in 6229. It's not there. It is identical. And what the Supreme Court determined in Colony is that, and this is very important, there's two things. One is it construed the statute to Chief Judge Santel's comments. We're talking about omits. Omits is very clear. It means to leave something out of the equation or leave something out.
Yeah, leave like omits. Gross income.
What's that?
Like gross income. You didn't put, you omitted to put in sufficient amounts of gross income. Now, the reason you did it is because you inflated the cost basis. So I don't, it's, with all due respect to Justice Harlan, I don't get it. And the fact of the matter is that, what's the opinion by Judge Boudin in the First Circuit? He basically says the same thing, and he clerked for Justice Harlan. I mean, you know.
We don't want to personalize right. These things. Right.
Well, I think the issue in this, and it comes down to, again, the Supreme Court's dictate in Rodriguez-Aquinas. Here we have the identical statute, the identical issue, whether an overstatement of basis constitutes an omission of gross income. And to your point, Judge Randolph, Judge Harlan addresses that issue, the question, and says, well, Yeah, we've heard this argument, and this argument, the same argument that the commissioner is arguing today.
We have to hold that omits to unambiguously mean what you say it does to avoid the Brand Rex problem.
I don't necessarily think that's true.
If we held there was an ambiguity in that term, would we not then have to defer to the regulation under Chevron?
Let me start with the Brand X issue, because one of the things that Brand X does say is that if we defer looking at prior precedent, if it unambiguously...
Isn't all precedent prior?
You're right. I'm sorry.
By the way, we don't get to Brand X, right, if you're wrong about Colony. Isn't that true? In other words, if Colony doesn't control, we don't have to ever get to Brand X, right?
I would agree, Your Honor. If the issue is decided on Colony in favor of the commissioner, there's no need for the regulations.
Right.
But under Rodriguez-Aquias, the Supreme Court's decision must control. It has not been reversed by the Supreme Court. It's the identical language, identical statute.
Okay, if the 54 code means what you say it means, why did Congress add those two new paragraphs?
Well, going back to where...
Why was it needed? Because under your interpretation of this, the generic language of this provision is not limited to... It applies to all taxpayers. So that would have covered any activity connected to a trade or business also. So why was it, if it meant what you say it meant, why did they add one and two?
Well, I think as the Federal Circuit found in Salmon Ranch that these provisions, Romanet 1 and 2, are put in and are part of the computational analysis that goes through only after it's determined that an omission has taken place. In Colony, the court says that...
One defines... For the purpose of this subsection, Romanet 1 defines the term gross income. So you have to read the generic language in terms of what 1 says it means. So my point is, I still don't understand the answer to my question. Under your theory of this statute, 1 and 2 weren't needed.
I think...
For inflated bases.
Yeah.
Maybe it was in non-inflated bases situations, but for an inflated basis, wasn't needed, right?
I agree. In an inflated basis cases, it's not an issue.
It's not an issue. This is an inflated basis case. If we interpret this language in view of Colony, then we've basically converted 1 and 2 into a complete surplusage. It's not needed. And we're not supposed to do that.
I don't think it's superfluous because what happens in that and where we've seen the case, particularly the case that was cited by the commissioner for its premise, is that comes into play and that becomes an issue and it's a question when the fact of the omission is not at issue, that there is an agreed upon stipulated omission. And the question comes out into the computational analysis of whether that omission results in 25%, a 25%
but
omission.
Do you agree with me? Romanet 1 defines a term. That's what it does. It's a definition of a term used earlier in the statute.
Defines
gross income.
It defines gross income for specific situations where you have a goods or services in the sale of the goods or services. So we have a different situation again in Colony. Colony creates a larger, different structure around it. The case in Colony dealt with the sale of land, which is not a sale of goods and services. But one of the things that I think that what Romanet 1 does do is it actually broadens the holding in Colony, because what it's talking about here is costs of goods sold. And when you look at cost of goods sold, those things, cost of goods sold, will encompass things which does not necessarily or wouldn't be included in what you would originally consider basis. Things like certain amortized development costs, those types of things. If you look at a 1065 return, cost of goods sold, talks about 362 CAPE.
Judge Tatel's question answered. You are past your allotted time, unless my colleagues have further questions. We'll call upon the co-appellee.
Your Honors.
Morning, Ms. Martins.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Jimmy Martins here for UTM. I would like to go back to this ambiguity argument that has surfaced in Colony, because we believe it's clear that Colony is not ambiguous. And going to the
but
point.
The question is whether the statute's ambiguous.
Well, not the Colony. Statute, 6501 E1A, was the successor statute to 275C, the statute that Colony dealt with. Colony stated that its holding was in harmony with the unambiguous language, and it cited.
But the unambiguous language it was in harmony with was the two newly adopted.
Well, it cited to A, didn't cite to little one and little two, and even if it did, there is an explanation for why the holding of Colony extends in all cases of not counting overstated basis as an omission of gross income for these reasons. Little one dealt with the sale of goods. Colony did not deal with the sale of goods. It dealt with the sale of improved land. Little I was added to tell the IRS how to calculate gross income, the denominator in the fraction, not what was included in gross income. But if you look at the parenthetical in little I, it talks about a computation. For purposes of the computation, you've got two numbers. What was omitted and what is the amount of gross income stated on the return? The legislative history under the 39 code talked about a debate for the 54 code, talked about a debate between senators of this computation, and Salmon Ranch tells us that little I was added to resolve a dispute about the computation of gross income, not was omitted. Colony's focus on omission dealt with the legislative history as a whole, and it noted that it found no solid support for the government's position. That was the language of the Supreme Court, that overstated basis constitutes an omission of gross income. Little two, the adequate disclosure provision, was added because of a case called SLAF. SLAF dealt with wages received from the American Red Cross, and what SLAF did was he didn't include them in the column or in the block of for gross income. Instead, he put a note attached to the back of the return. And so two was added to handle those cases where there was a note or some kind of reporting on the return that was outside of the gross income portion of the return. So you've got little one and little two handling legislative matters that were addressed outside of Colony. And then you have Colony in a broad context stating that omission means items left out, and it talked about omitted dividends, and in the legislative history, omitted interest income, and other types of situations where the government was at a special disadvantage.
What evidence was there that list in the colloquy was intended to be exhaustive under the 39 Act?
It didn't say the evidence that the list was intended to be exhaustive
let me add one other thing about that. The you say omit doesn't mean understate,
right?
But in fact, the committee report in 1939 said that it did.
Right, and Colony answered.
And then Justice Harlan said, "Well, I don't know what they meant by that."
But Colony answers that, and Colony says, when you see the phrase understates gross income, it is immediately followed by more detailed explanations of exactly what Congress meant. And following that, it said, as a result, we find no solid support for the government. The government's
If we decide that Colony does not control, does that mean you lose?
No, sir, it does. No, Your Honor, it does not.
Why is it that you that you think you'd prevail regardless whether Colony controls?
Because on October 16, 2003, and September 15th for my co-counsel's client, the statute of the there were no regulations. They wouldn't come for 6 years. The law was Colony, or if Colony didn't exist, it was 6501E1A and the legislative history. On that date, we didn't have the regulations, and on that date, if you redid Colony, if you retried the Colony case, you would come to
Colony. Judge Randolph's question, suppose Colony was not controlling.
Okay, if Colony was not controlling on that date, October 16, 2003, 6 years prior to the regulations, all we had was 6501E1A and the partnership provisions and the legislative history. And there is no reason, given the analysis that the Supreme Court made in Colony, that you would arrive at a different conclusion than what the Supreme Court arrived at in 1958. So, for that reason alone, we would prevail.
Okay, so that goes to the almost obliquely presented question or argument by the government that the regulation does act essentially retroactively.
Well, they say it does. They say in the preamble it does not act retroactively, but then they
treat it as if it did act.
Right, and we say the Supreme Court in the Smiley case rejected any claim that the statute or that a regulation promulgated during the course of litigation regarding transactions that had occurred at the time the agency's guide had no formal guidance was retroactive. I mean, the Supreme Court rejected that, right? I mean, it's footnote 4 of Smiley.
Smiley was a case where the government was not a party, and we distinguish Smiley. Well, the government didn't have a stake in the outcome like they have a stake here. Here, if we
there
allow
the
government,
there are cases just like Smiley where the government was not a party.
I'm sorry,
sir? There are cases just like Smiley where the government was not a party.
Well, the government was not a party. Yeah, they were not defying congressional
intent. I don't think that argument's going to help you.
Okay, yeah. Well, yeah. Then, but they
that
were
is not a powerful argument.
Is this your argument that the temporary regulations are invalid?
Regulations are invalid.
Because they were in place at the time, right?
And by their terms do not apply.
Why? The commissioner has interpreted them as apply.
Right.
Why wouldn't we defer to that?
You do not defer to that because that's in the preamble, and there is no basis for deference to the statements made in the preamble when they conflict with the body of the regulation, which states an effective date of September 24th, 2009. Auer tells us, Auer versus Robin tells us.
But if the six-year provision applies, wasn't that timely?
In our case, no, Your Honor, and the reason why is they sent the wrong notice. They sent a partnership notice to the wrong entity.
Well, that's a different argument. Well, go ahead with that. That's a different argument. But
okay,
you go ahead and say what you want to say.
Okay. The government issued a partnership notice out of time, 6 years and 2 months after the partnership filed its tax return, to an entity that it believed was a sham. But for purposes of the summary judgment proceeding for the statutes of limitations, it stipulated that UTAM, the partnership, was not a sham. The transaction the government seeks to set aside occurred at a different level. It occurred in an S corporation that was the owner of the partnership. And that is the alternate legal ground upon which you can sustain our petition or sustain our position, because it was sent too late, it did not involve any partnership items that remained in issue, and it was sent to the wrong party. What should have happened was the government should have sent a statutory notice of deficiency to my clients prior to the running of the 6501A period, which is 3 years, may I continue? I'm out of time.
Well, go ahead and finish your thought there, please.
They sent the notice out of time. 6501A, providing for the three-year statute, expired on October 16th, 2003, 6 years before these regulations were issued. And to apply these regulations retroactively reopens an expired statute of limitations. Because the statute, Hughes Aircraft and Chenault, which is a Ninth Circuit case, that was endorsed.
Point there is that they would reopen an already closed statute of limitations,
right? Yes, they would, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Unless my colleagues have further questions, then your time has expired. And
thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Appellant had... You have 3 minutes. Go ahead.
I just want to clear up one matter there. The statute, if the six-year period applies, the statute has not run on any of these cases. The only things that would, if this court reverses, would have to go back. I do believe.
What about this last argument that he just made about sending the thing to the wrong party?
The statute, the FPAW, the equivalent,
right,
the FPAW was issued within 6 years. Uh-huh. It was not, I mean, you have to issue the F, if it's a partnership item, you issue the FPAW regarding the partnership. Now, sometimes you can have a statute expire as to non-partnership items. So when you have an FPAW, issue an FPAW, then the only thing that can be changed are the partnership items, but that's what we're seeking to change in this case is the partnership items.
That's because of 6229.
229, right, exactly. The only points I'd like to make is that with regard to, you know, whether Colony would still be, the statement of the Supreme Court that Colony is, our conclusion is consistent in the cert papers in
Colony. By the way, that's dicta, isn't it? 6501 was not before the Supreme Court.
That is definitely dicta.
But it was part of the reasoning as to why the analysis of the other section was correct.
We're
looking at the whole scheme and we're consistent with
right. What the government said to the Supreme Court in Colony is that the and I'm just quoting from page 6 of the cert response, the Internal Revenue Code of 1954 has rendered moot as to tax years covered by the new code, the questions here presented. So that was just pointing out that for the trade or business, as I mentioned, Colony.
Because of sub I, the company
sub
there,
I
tried to figure out what they were in the business of selling real estate, but is real estate goods and services?
Real estate was it was a trade or business, and it was considered to be inventory. The rules for the sale of goods and services include inventory, even if it's held by a real estate developer.
Oh, okay.
The last point I want to mention is that, you know, what happened in the Federal Circuit in Grapevine is exactly what should happen here, and that is the government before the Federal Circuit lost under the statute. The regulation was finalized. Same issue comes before the Federal Circuit, and the Federal Circuit says, well, now that the regulation has been issued and we have an ambiguous statute, we defer to the regulation.
But one question, Mr. Rothenberg. One of the other alternative arguments I think both of them make is that we can affirm on the grounds that there was adequate disclosure. And one of the parties has this affidavit saying any reasonable revenue agent should have known this. And you didn't answer that in your brief at all.
Well, we didn't answer for two reasons.
Yeah.
One is that adequate disclosure is not before the court. And secondly, almost all of these shelters, boss shelters were designed to obfuscate what was going on so that revenue agents would not find out about it.
Well,
some of these cases, by the way, that I've read indicate that the law... I'm sorry.
I was just going to ask you, what do we do with that? I mean...
I believe the conclusion...
I mean, there's an affidavit and there's no response. And, in fact, there's no response from the commissioner at all in this argument.
Well, whether or not an agent would find it or not is not the question. The proper question is whether there was adequate disclosure on the return.
Yeah.
So then I do believe that if both of these appellees raise the adequate disclosure question in the tax court, that would have to be remanded.
Okay.
Or the determination
not to
of adequate
decided here. Not to be
no,
decided
no,
here.
No, 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 that was never briefed.
And okay.
I just some of these cases indicate that the line and the way to interpret is that the reason that the statute of limitations is extended to 6 years is because the whatever the omission is, it would be difficult for the Internal Revenue Service to detect it. And I just wonder about that because it seems to me, particularly given the 25%.
Yeah.
Requirement that small errors or misstatements are much more difficult to detect than if somebody omits $10 million from the sale of whatever it is, as opposed to omitting $500. And so you don't really take that tack, but there are some cases that seem to suggest that that is the line that in light of which a court should interpret 6501.
Well, the whole point of that, the numerical 25%, is that the Congress did not want relatively small errors to extend the statute to 6 years. But if we're correct in terms of that, there, you cannot have an inflated basis in a son of boss, and every court has held you cannot do that, then we're way above the 25% amount. So that's a significant, we're talking millions of dollars here. Thank you, Your Honor.
Last technical question.
Sure.
Going back to this FPAA, yes, the issue, what did you call it?
It's called an FPAW. At least that's what the IRS agents call
it. Okay, all right. So
administrative adjustment.
You say in your brief that the argument that the taxpayers make on this relies inappropriately on concessions or stipulations the government made in a different context, right?
Yes.
Can you just explain that in, like, English so we can understand?
Well, I'm not quite sure I understand it. Myself.
Well, then we're in big trouble because
The idea behind it is that somehow the other side believes that we've stipulated away our case. Now, we didn't believe that. The tax court certainly didn't believe that. But in order to get the legal issue, has the statute of limitations run? And so the government on summary judgment, if I remember the actual paper, said, we'll assume it's not a sham just for purposes of the statute of limitations. The son of boss, no deductions have been upheld in this particular tax shelter by any court that has been upheld on appeal. Does that answer your question?
We've had questions touching upon that before.
But this issue wasn't decided by the tax court, right?
No, it was not.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, the case is submitted. Give us recess.